Good morning. It's 9 minutes after 7 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here for Joy Cardine this week. She'll be back on Monday. The book we're going to be discussing this hour is titled Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And the title of the book pretty much says it all in some regards. Alan Shawn would seem to be a success to the average person who is taking a look at his life. And while he is a success by many measures, Shawn feels that he has missed a lot of life because of his fears. He's afraid of heights, of water, fields, parking lots, tunnels, unknown roads, and that is just the start. In his book, Alan Shawn takes a close look at his world, a relatively unsparing look, and we'll be talking with him today about how his fears have made his life what it is. All of us, of course, are afraid of certain things, but have you ever experienced these kinds of phobias? If you have, how have you coped? Or how have you dealt with a friend or family member who has fears like this, or panic attacks, or fears that seem to outsiders to be irrational? You can join the conversation this morning by calling 800-642-1234. If you're calling from Madison, it is 263-1890. And you can also join by email, if you like, at talk@wpr.org. We welcome Alan Shawn to Wisconsin Public Radio, and good morning.
Good morning, Gene.
First of all, just a quick comment on the style of your book. There's a lot of sort of technical information in there, but, you know, for someone who might be interested in picking it up, it's very readable.
Thank you. I tried to write a book that was a fascinating book to read for anybody, and that, in a way, anyone could identify with in some respect.
And let's talk about why you chose to write it in the first place. Obviously, you have been living with a lot of these fears for a very, very long time. And this is the sort of thing I think that a lot of people would just as soon sort of keep to themselves, keep it hidden. And at some point in your life, so I don't want to say late in life, but you're in your 40s or 50s?
I'm 58 years old.
Okay, there we go. You've got a few years under your belt.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you chose to write this book. Why?
Well, you're right. I have lived with these problems for a long time. And I don't talk about them very much. And they're a kind of dark side to my personality, you might say. There's certainly things I don't put on my resume. And yet, precisely because I haven't really gotten over them, and because I felt I was in a position to articulate what these things feel like and investigate them a bit, I decided to do the one thing I could do, which was share them with the larger world and not just speak out about them, but try to almost donate them to society in some way so that they would become a part of a larger discussion. You know, the nature of these problems is that we suffer them alone, and they're very isolating in many ways, not only because they keep you from doing things, but because you feel that your reactions are so abnormal while you're having them that you feel terrible about yourself, and you feel particularly alone because you know that most people won't understand what you're going through. So I decided to do something, you might say, counterphobic with these phobias and express them. And it has been difficult and painful. I'd much rather be known for my music and for the things that I'm proud of in my life.
And let's talk about those for a second. Let's start with that because, you know, your resume, we can use that term, I guess. You look like a success. There's no two ways about it if you look at that piece of paper.
Well, I didn't write this book because I think that I'm a failure or a freak of nature. Quite the contrary. I actually do believe that we all have enormous deficits in us and that we tend to only look at certain aspects of our personality. And the fact that I've done a lot that I'm proud of and that that has made me, you know, something of a functioning human being is part of my story. And I also discuss other people in the book whom I feel have done wonderful things or valuable things, whose problems are actually directly related to the positive things they've done. So it's part of the point of my book. But yes, I'm a composer. I started writing music a long time ago, roughly when I was 10 years old. And I've written an awful lot of it, chamber music and orchestral music and choral music and several short operas. I worked in the theater in New York. I'm a pianist. I've written one book previously about composer Arnold Schoenberg. I teach at Bennington College. I'm a pretty outgoing person, despite the difficulties I have getting out. I have two children, wonderful children. I live a very full life. At the same time, if you look at the flip side of my life, I have these enormous problems. I'm claustrophobic, and I avoid elevators and subways and airplanes. I have difficulty driving on roads where I can't see houses, so I have difficulty with many highways and with getting all kinds of places that I very much want to get to. I have difficulty in open spaces. You listed fields and parking lots. It's not that I'm literally afraid of, let's say, a parking lot.
Right.
You know, if you showed me a picture of a parking lot, I wouldn't cringe. If you ask me to walk across a very open space, like a parking lot, particularly if there are no cars in it, I would feel very unsteady. Some people say that these spatial reactions have a neurological origin, and that they really are not emotionally based. I'm not qualified to know if that's my case, but I have come to see, as I've researched phobias, that phobias are a manifestation, like a rash, and you can have them for all kinds of different reasons, and there are medical causes in some cases, like inner ear disturbances that affect balance, and there may very well be, and apparently are, neurological causes in some people's cases. So one has to assume that each person has a slightly different history in terms of these types of problems.
Okay, we've got to take a break now. When we return, we'll continue our discussion from the book Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. We invite your calls at 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The time is 18 minutes past 7 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. Coming up after 4 o'clock, share your comments on the top news stories of the week. Peter Donalds welcomes your views on the news. That's up this afternoon on the Ideas Network. This hour, we are talking about the book Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. Alan Shawn is the author, and we're inviting your comments, your questions as well. 263-1890 is the number you can call if you're in Madison. And everywhere else, we have a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can join us by email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Alan Shawn, before the break, we were talking a bit about some of the specific things that you are afraid of. And, you know, if you look back, you talked briefly about, I think you mentioned history, and right. Your family history is an interesting one. And I think if a lot of people might get to that point in your book and they'd go, oh, well, there it is. And certainly, you know, that may be part of it, but I don't know if that's the whole story.
Yes. Well, there are quite a few things I talk about in terms of my family history. First of all, my father was William Shawn, who was editor of The New Yorker for 35 years, an amazing, amazing human being, and a master of language. He also suffered terribly from what we call agoraphobia today. Excuse me, I still have a bit of the flu, by the
way. Sure.
And I certainly have a lot of the problems he did. Because of the way his life was structured, working at the New Yorker magazine, at the center of a tremendous amount of fantastic activity, he managed to have a very adventurous existence and a fascinating one, without doing many of the things that troubled him. So he did not have to travel very much. In fact, after, the age of 40 or so, he left Manhattan very, very rarely and never went anywhere other than a couple of visits to Chicago, where he'd grown up, and from time to time to south of New Jersey, just barely south of New Jersey. And that was his maximum radius of travel. He took very few elevators. He never rode the subway. And he never rode in an airplane in his whole life. So he was an excellent role model for a phobic, and all the more so because he was so appealing and admirable. And as a son, you know, sons mm-hmm. take after their father. So you might say, right there, that's enough. On the other hand, his brother and one of his sisters and his mother also had phobias, and they were not his children. Most experts seem to say that there's a strong genetic component behind these kinds of issues. Also, my brother, who is Wallace Shawn, who's very well known as an actor, but he's also a phenomenal playwright and writer, does not have these phobias that I have, and he had our father as a role model too. So there's that right there. If you want to say that's an excellent start.
But it's interesting that, you know, that he was a good role model for you in the sense that, you know, he was very successful, and built his life sort of to accommodate, you know, the things that he wasn't really prepared to deal with.
Yes, I think part of what I am getting at in my book is that a lot of people who think they are unlike me, let's say, or unlike my father, might not have noticed that by instinct they have also formed their lives around what they can do, avoiding what they can't do. It's absolutely natural. For example, I teach at a college and I perform frequently at concerts. Well, if performance anxiety and public speaking were my main fears, I would have tailored my life to, let's say, sit at a computer all day and do things totally through email and not speak to people and not appear in public. By instinct, I have found things that activities in which I can function relatively comfortably, and I have instinctively avoided the things that I don't seem to be comfortable doing. Now, in terms of my my history, obviously, central to my story in the book is the fact that I'm a twin, and my twin sister Mary is autistic, and not just autistic, but part schizophrenic and mentally retarded. And so, on the one hand, I grew up alongside her. I was formed alongside her, which is a, you know, mind-boggling thought. And I spent 8 years as her twin, growing up in New York with her in the house and with me. And then at the age of eight, she was sent to an institution by my parents, a move that was very common at that in that era. We're talking about 1956 here, and may very well have been the best thing for her, and was certainly not done in a violent way, but certainly was at the same time a catastrophe for a young child like myself. So I had the stresses and difficulties of growing up alongside her, and then the trauma of losing her at that age. And again, characteristic of that era was a lack of good family discussion of what was happening there. So there was this disaster, I just internalized it. I have absolutely no memory of anything other than a couple of sentences being said on the subject. So you might say, there it is right there about that, you know, that mm-hmm. the trauma was the beginning of my difficulty navigating in the world freely. I have so many possible causes listed in my book that I think each reader will come to a different conclusion about what this author's difficulty really is.
We're talking about the book Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. Alan Shaun is the author, and he joins us on the phone. If you'd like to join us on the phone, you can do it at 800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. And as you say, Alan Shaun, there are a lot of causes listed in the book, and you know, someone who is a thoughtful reader could easily come to any number of conclusions. And I think that's kind of part of the deal, is that this is not a simple equation here.
I totally agree. What I do in the book is I tell my own story, but because at least two of my family members are so well known, I slightly abstract it. I don't, after the introduction in which I identify everybody, I don't use people's names, although I give my sister a particular edge by giving her, I call her by name throughout the text because I want the reader to feel that she's central and to have a real picture of her in their mind. But alongside my own story, I write about the investigating I've done and all the research I've done into the brain and into evolution, into Freudian psychology, and write about those things from a layman's perspective, a search for an understanding of what these types of problems are. And in the end, it's very much a book about our place in nature, and I came to many realizations by writing the book about who we all are, and the book opens out into a much larger subject about the fact that our what we think of as our thoughts and our personalities are embedded in nature in every respect, that mind and matter and the natural world are all one thing, really. Phobia is nothing more than a kind of slightly misused fight or flight response, a misuse of the fear mechanism that evolution has perfected over eons so that we can deal with dangers and threats. So when we're experiencing a phobia, we are very inconvenienced, but we're also seeing nature at work, and we're seeing that evolution is not perfect.
And we have to stop it here. We have
yes.
a break to take, but we will return. Alan Shaun is our guest this morning, the author of the new book, Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 24 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Alan Shaun today. He is the author of Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life, and it's his book about his life and some of his phobias, for lack of a better word. We're inviting your calls at 800-642-1234. In Madison, it is 263-1890. You can also join us by email, and that address is talk@wpr.org. Alan Shaun, we did have a caller who couldn't hang on, unfortunately.
Oh.
But he talked about, he wanted us to leave a note, and we've got it here,
yes.
That says he has a fear of heights now, and yes. says it's something he didn't have when he was younger, It grew over time when he started to lose his athletic ability. He's in his 70s now.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, because that brings up the point or the question of how these phobias, how these fears evolve, because you can easily start at one place in your life and wind up in another place sometimes.
Yes, I have thought about that. You know, my own case is so different from that, in the sense that I can look back and see this problem growing through childhood and sort of blossoming as I became an adult. And of course, I'm a layperson here, and I'm not a psychologist or neurologist, or I have no medical training. I would say that it seems like a lot of people tell me that these problems have hit them at moments of transition and change. It's famously the case that when you graduate from college and you first separate from your parents, that this elicits things psychologically that might have been kind of laying wait for you through your childhood. So I guess this gentleman's case might be similar at a different stage of life, that somehow the athleticism he had gave him a sense of power and security in some way, and that losing that side of his life left him vulnerable, and that's expressed in this way. I mean, I'm only hazarding a guess here, but I feel that that the tendency to have phobias is absolutely innate and can be brought out by moments of insecurity like the one he's experiencing, or moments of deep transition, loss and change. Certainly, if you have a traumatic incident, for example, I mentioned one in the book of a woman who was a swimmer who dove into a lake and encountered a corpse in the water, and was so shaken up by that it was very, very hard to get her near water after that. Makes perfect sense. There was nothing wrong with her. There was an incident that triggered this very natural association between water and a terrible shock. And in a more subtle way, I think we encounter that when we have injuries to our sense of safety in the world. We feel vulnerable, and it might emerge in a reaction like the one this man has.
Yeah, and when you brought that up, it almost brings out the reaction after 9/11, almost on a much larger scale.
Absolutely. We're made to cope with the world. You know, nature is beyond wondrous. If we took in everything that was around us at every moment, we couldn't function. We have to sort out the world. And there's plenty of danger in the world. But if we go through life being fearful at every moment, that just won't do. That's not a good... A species that had that as its main tendency wouldn't survive. So we need to be able to cope with danger and with threats. And at the same time, we need to be able to move forward through life in a relatively optimistic way without being fearful at every moment. But meantime, the world is unpredictable, full of dangers, full of difficulties and suffering. So when an enormous cataclysm occurs, such as happens in a war or in the 9/11 massacre, we feel this incredibly primal sense of vulnerability that nature has designed for us to feel, and have to sort out how to apply that. It's very interesting because, as you say, on a huge scale, as a nation, for example, we had to try to sort out, and we're still trying to sort out, what this should mean to us. How scared should we be? How protective of ourselves should we be? What attitudes should we adopt in response to it? And that's all really a part of nature at work. It's seems to me.
800-642-1234, if you'd like to join in. In Madison, it is 263-1890. And we go to the phones now, and Scott joins us in Waterville, Iowa. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 39 now, and I guess I've been dealing with agoraphobia, panic disorder stuff since, I guess I'm assuming since high school, but I know I dealt with it through alcohol for a long time until actually I entered alcohol rehab. And since that time, about the age of 22, I've been dealing with it in a more healthy way. And I guess I was just wondering about the connection between the phobias and drug abuse, alcohol abuse, and possibly the number of people that end up dealing with it that way.
Scott, thanks for the question. We'll put it to our guest, Alan Shawn. It seems to me that might be one way that people might try to make their lives a little easier.
That is a great question, Scott. I happen to know from my research that you are absolutely right, and particularly a lot of men deal with these fears by kind of self-medicating with alcohol or drugs. In our society, men are supposed to, not be so fearful, and they're supposed, even though we have moved beyond the gender stereotypes of the old days, men still feel very ashamed to speak up about their weaknesses. And of course, men have traditionally been out in the workplace and doing things very often that made them terribly anxious. And then they, you're absolutely right, often self-medicate with alcohol, particularly alcohol, and sometimes with drugs. Women, too. I've had some letters from women who said they had these problems and used to be heavy drinkers to try to deal with it. Obviously, social anxieties, about which I don't say a whole lot in my book, but if you could apply everything I do say to social anxieties, particularly bring out that tendency. And a lot of people drink so that they can be more comfortable in social situations and large gatherings. I'm curious. I don't know if Scott is still on the line, but I'd be very interested to know whether he's doing better now dealing with these problems in a what he calls a more healthy way.
Am I here?
Yeah, you're there.
Great.
Yes, I am.
You want to talk about what treatments you're finding effective?
Well, actually, I used to go to therapy and went through a few different group therapy-type sessions. Now, basically what I've done is just try to slowly meet my fears and I guess try to, what I would call it is just try to bring myself into them slow enough that I can become basically numb to them. So I'm a teacher now. I just started my first full year of teaching in the fall. So I've got just about a year and a half of teaching under my belt, which would have been impossible a few years ago. So I guess that's kind of how I've approached it. For me, big cities have been virtually impossible. I couldn't hardly get myself to go to one. Now I go to them now and then, and I've gone more and more. I guess that's part of how I've dealt with it.
All right, Scott. Well, listen, thanks for the call. And Alan Shawn, we've got a break here, but when we come back, we've got some more calls lined up, and we'll continue our conversation about the book Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. We're talking with Alan Shawn this hour, who wrote it, and inviting your calls. 800-642-1234. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The time is 12 minutes before 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell. Don't forget, coming up after 8 o'clock this morning, it is the Week in Review. So stick around for that. We'll take a look back at the week that was in the news. This hour, we are talking with Alan Shawn, the author of Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And we've got a couple calls we'll be getting to in just a moment, inviting your calls as well at 800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And Alan Shawn, before the break, we were talking to Scott in Waterville, Iowa. And, you know, while he was talking, it occurred to me that everyone's journey in this is very, very individual. There is no really clear rule of thumb.
I think that's right. But he, of course, raised a marvelous point that I could hardly underscore enough, and that is that these new techniques that people are learning, that have been around now, I guess, for the maybe the past 20, 30 years, that the cognitive behavioral therapists have worked out are really based on such a plausible principle, which is that, the mind is a formation of patterns, pathways, literally. And if you've associated certain things with terror and danger, no amount of talking about it is going to change that association. You actually have to go out and experience these things with new perspectives and gradually change the way your own brain responds to them. It's a kind of learning and teaching, and it can be done. And some people make a dramatic recovery from these types of problems.
Let's get to some calls. We do have some people who'd like to talk with you. Jane joins us from Appleton. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Let me change phones.
Okay. And I'll fill here for just a moment.
Okay,
while
I'm on the phone.
All
now.
Right, she's back. Okay, you're on the air, Jane.
Okay. I'm a psychotherapist.
Yes.
And I've worked with anxiety disorders using a good many non-medical methods, although I do also refer people for medication. And several years ago, I was trained in an energy work technique called thought field therapy. It uses having the person tap on a series of acupressure points in order to change emotions. And I've seen it give very dramatic results, particularly for simple phobias.
Yes.
Also for PTSD symptoms.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if Mr. Shawn has ever learned about this, if he has ever tried it, and what his understanding about it is.
All right, Jane, thanks for the call. Alan Shawn.
Well, I've never used acupuncture or the method that Jane describes. I have heard about it, and some people swear by it. I don't know if the listeners know the term simple phobias, but Jane's making a distinction between the isolated, specific phobia, like a fear of spiders, and an agoraphobia, which is certainly my problem, which is somewhat more general. No, I've never tried that method. I have been through traditional therapy for many years and also been to a number of clinics for phobias that were more in the cognitive domain, and I have been helped by those methods.
Let's go to Reed now, who joins us from West Bend. Hi, Reed.
Hi, Gene. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
I'm a professional storyteller, and I was drawn to your comment earlier in the discussion about how you're telling the story of your phobias in your book and in conversations like this. My question is, what, if any, effect do you think you've experienced in mastering or overcoming your phobias or coping with them better through the course of the telling of the stories of the various therapies you've had and the experiences you've had with them?
Well, I think it my own experience telling this story has not alleviated my phobias or changed my essential reactions to these things, but it has changed my life and my perspective on myself. And as I said, earlier in the program, we live our lives alone, and we suffer alone. Suffering, by its nature, people can empathize with each other, but you can't feel truly another person's pain and suffering. So to take this very lonely and very desperate experience, this pain, and turn it into something more artistic, articulate it, try to write something that has some literary merit about these things, has changed the nature of what that is. At the very least, I've taken something that makes me feel powerless and used it in a constructive way. So it's connected me to other people in a new way. More importantly, perhaps, and even than that, is that when you are ashamed of a side of yourself that is absolutely hardwired, or maybe until I do that acupuncture treatment Jane mentioned, you're carrying around this shadow everywhere you go, but you're not really talking about it, and you're really living with one hand tied behind your back. And this happens to people who are gamblers or who are closeted gays or whatever. You can't hold a part of yourself hostage without it's affecting your whole personality. So it's been a very difficult experience, but I'm a more whole person as a result.
Let's go to Milwaukee right now, and Mike joins us. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Interesting topic. I have two thoughts. One is your phobia has become your identity, and you're being rewarded for it by being on the radio and selling books. And so consequently, it's being reinforced by your occupation. Number two, I'm interested in the word ambivalence. Is ambivalence a form of attraction and repulsion at the same time, so the person becomes frozen in time, so to speak? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, your first comment is very interesting, and I do think about that. The last thing I would want to do is to become a professional phobic and have this writing simply be a kind of self-enabling of the problems I have. And I have thought about that, and I hope to keep working on my problems, and someday I'll write a book about how terrible it was I used to have these problems. But thank you for mentioning that, and I'm aware of it. Ambivalence, yes, I think very often we're afraid of things that also are deeply attractive to us, if that's what you're suggesting there. Even in relation to music, I feel the terror of music as well as the ecstasy of music. And music is, central to my life. Beneath my fear of traveling, I think there's a very adventurous world traveler. I've often thought about that. I used to collect maps. I'm very interested in hearing about places all over the world. And I don't know if that answers your question, but I think phobias are often the flip side of an interest.
We've only got a few minutes left, but before we go at the top of the hour, Alan Shaun, I was while you were talking about your father and talking about writing the book, I was wondering what would he think of this book and whether he ever, he was certainly of a totally different generation, but what would he think of what you have done here?
I couldn't have written this book if my parents were alive. That's quite clear to me. On some spiritual plane, I think he would be proud of my doing this. It would be hard for him because there's so much about him in the book, and he was a very private person. I think he would applaud my trying to forge ahead with my life in whatever way I can. And I think he would be pleased to see that I'm, you know, working on my writing.
What would he have given you as a writing grade? Tough question.
It's very hard. He was quite a perfectionist. And as an editor, you have to be.
But you're his son, so he'd be plus anyway.
Oh, I think so. Yes, he would be proud.
All right, fair enough. Alan Shaun, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Alan Shaun has been with us for the past hour. He is the author of the book, Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And we've been talking about how phobias can affect your life. The book, by the way, is published by Viking. If you'd like a copy of the program that you've heard today, you can have one by calling the radio store at 800-747-7444. And you can ask for program 323B as in boy. You can also listen to the program online. It's free of charge. Go to our Wisconsin Public Radio archives at WPR.org, and you can find a copy of it there for you as well. Carmen Jackson produced this hour, and we had on-air production from Leo Duran. Coming up next hour, stay tuned. We'll be talking about the week in review, taking a look back at the week that was and finding out what you think as well as our guests. It's all coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm sitting in this week for Joy Cardine.